from Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile.
As long as the United States of America is determined and strong, this will not be an age of terror.
As President Bush addresses the nation, thousands of Afghani civilians flee their country in terror. We'll talk to Noam Chomsky about terrorism in practice and propaganda. And two women, one who lost her husband, the other her brother, in the World Trade Center attacks, speak out against war. All that and more coming up on Democracy Now! in Exile's War and Peace Report. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, just blocks from where the World Trade Center towers once stood. I'm Amy Goodman. Afghanistan's Taliban rulers today refused to hand over Osama bin Laden and warned that U.S. attempts to apprehend him by force could plunge the whole region into crisis. The announcement came hours after President Bush demanded that Afghanistan immediately deliver bin Laden and shut down every terrorist training camp in the country or face military attack by the United States. The Taliban ambassador to Pakistan, Abdul Salam Zaif, called for an investigation into the attacks by the United Nations, saying, quote, "Our position on this is that if America has proof, we're ready for the trial of Osama bin Laden in light of the evidence." Zaif also said he was sorry people died in the suicide jet attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon last week, but appealed to the United States not to endanger innocent people in a military retaliation, and said that President Bush's ultimatum poses great danger to Muslims. President Bush delivered the ultimatum in a nationally televised speech to a joint session of Congress last night. He warned the war would include the deployment of ground troops and would likely involve the loss of American lives. The London-based newspaper The Guardian is reporting that the U.S. government is pressing its European allies to agree to a military campaign to topple the Taliban regime of Afghanistan and replace it with an interim administration under United Nations auspices. Diplomatic cables from the Washington embassy of a key NATO ally seen by The Guardian report that the U.S. is keen to hear allied views on, quote, post-Taliban Afghanistan after the liberation of the country. The embassy cable reveals that the U.S. administration is bent on force to evict the Taliban from power because of the shelter it's offered Osama bin Laden, named by the White House as prime suspect for the New York and Washington attacks. The Guardian has also learned that two large U.S. Hercules transport aircraft landed in Tashkent, capital of the former Soviet Republic of Uzbekistan, on Tuesday, loaded with surveillance equipment to be installed along the northern Afghan border. The secret landing represented a radical departure, since it appeared to herald the deployment of squadrons of U.S. fighters at Uzbekistan's sprawling airfield at Termez, directly on the border. Such a buildup would incur the wrath of Russia, which views the Central Asian republics as its backyard. The Pentagon yesterday continued its move to a war footing with orders for up to 130 heavy bombers, fighters, aerial refueling planes, and other combat aircraft to be deployed around the Middle East and the Central Asia region. The Army Secretary Thomas White said yesterday that ground troops are being sent to the region. The Navy has also sent an additional aircraft carrier toward the Middle East region, which along with the air deployment could place up to 500 U.S. warplanes in the Mediterranean, Gulf, and Indian Ocean areas. British Prime Minister Tony Blair in Washington last night to meet President Bush suggested that military strikes inside Afghanistan targeted on bin Laden's training camps could come in a matter of days. According to The Guardian, another plank in the U.S. military strategy appears to entail supporting the campaign of the exiled 86-year-old monarch of Afghanistan, King Zahir Shah, to return to power by encouraging the guerrilla army of the Northern Alliance opposition to fall in behind him. Diplomatic documents seen by The Guardian show that Washington is funding and organizing the travel of several Northern Alliance figures to Rome to confer with the exiled monarch, who's expected to call on all Afghan tribes to rise up in revolution against the Taliban. At least a million Afghans face starvation if the World Food Program cannot return evacuated staff to the country and resume its normal operations there. The World Food Program has still 3 weeks' worth of supplies in warehouses in Afghan cities, but it could not distribute it to rural areas hard hit by a severe drought and the crisis over Osama bin Laden. This, according to a spokesperson. Like all other United Nations agencies, the WFP had to evacuate its staff from Afghanistan hastily last week as the United States threatened to attack the country. Meanwhile, Yusuf Hassan, spokesperson for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, said 200,000 Afghans had fled their homes for the countryside or neighboring Pakistan. UNHCR says 15,000 Afghans have already entered Pakistan since September 12th, and thousands are waiting at the border to enter. Hassan said that Pakistan was letting in Afghans with valid visas, even though it's closed the border. A spokesperson for the UN Coordinator's Office for Humanitarian Activities for Afghanistan said the UN is particularly concerned about providing enough food, water, sanitation, and tents as winter fast approaches. She also said that crime in the Afghan capital of Kabul has increased, with shootings and armed robberies on the rise. New York City's already battered psyche was dealt another jarring blow yesterday when Mayor Rudolph Giuliani revealed the number of missing people has climbed to 6,333, an increase of 911. As it did last Friday, rain slowed the rescue efforts yesterday at the wreckage site, which yielded no survivors for an eighth consecutive day. The number of dead recovered now stands at 241. Mayor Giuliani says the increase in missing people is attributable to foreigners not previously included in the official tally, including 250 British nationals. Yesterday, more than 125 organizations joined in a statement warning that legislation and regulations adopted in the heat of anger could erode the liberties and freedoms that are at the core of the American way of life. The coalition, whose members range from the Conservative Eagle Forum and the Gun Owners of America to the Liberal National Lawyers Guild and the Gay and Lesbian Task Force, called for calm and deliberate action that honors constitutional rights, especially free speech, and avoids stigmatizing any racial, religious, or ethnic group. Organizations representing Muslim, Hispanic, Chinese, Japanese, and Arab Americans joined the alliance, along with such traditional groups as the NAACP and the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights. The groups are denouncing legislation that would widen the government's ability to detain or deport foreigners. The legislation would expand that to foreigners who support a subgroup not involved in terrorism, but which is associated with, quote, a terrorist organization. Already under sharp criticism is a section that would permit a foreigner to be detained for an unlimited amount of time during a national emergency.
From Jews for Racial and Economic Justice, and my sign says, mourn all the victims, pursue global peace and justice. And the reason why I'm here is both to mourn what already happened here and to make sure it doesn't happen abroad, like people in Afghanistan are already trying to flee as the U.S. is preparing for war. And I want to make sure that what happened here doesn't happen to them, and also that it doesn't escalate, and also to try to stop the violence and harassment that's happening to our Muslim and Arab and actually a lot of immigrant neighbors here in the U.S.
It's been a lot of talk about, Sharon's visit coming up and, you know, trying to drive a wedge between Jewish and Arabic communities.
Today, if you ask them to fight again, what do you think they'd say? I'm not trying to be funny, I'm just trying to get my point across. War is world's enemy number one, and it's time that we call it off. Stop the war now. Good God, hear me say it. Don't put it off another day. Everybody sing it. Stop the war now. Nah, 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 nah. Don't put it off another day. All we got to do is, Lord.
Down second. Lincoln Avenue from 72nd Street, and all along the street there are groups of people holding candles. There are people walking along by themselves holding candles, and at the corners there are all groups of people with candles in shops, and it's really moving.
I'm a child of World War II veterans, and I grew up in a very patriotic family. And I feel that I think it's good to look around and see all the younger people. There's a lot of students that they're feeling for their country too. And I think that the anti-war sentiment is very beautiful too. And just as a New Yorker, you know, New Yorkers are different Americans because we're so much from all over the place.
Stop the War Now, Edwin Starr, here on Democracy Now! in Exile, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Last night, President Bush addressed the nation.
We will direct every resource at our command, every means of diplomacy, every tool of intelligence, every instrument of law enforcement, every financial influence, and every necessary weapon of war, to the disruption and to the defeat of the global terror network. Now, this war will not be like the war against Iraq a decade ago, with a decisive liberation of territory and a swift conclusion. It will not look like the air war above Kosovo 2 years ago, where no ground troops were used and not a single American was lost in combat. Our response involves far more than instant retaliation and isolated strikes. Americans should not expect one battle, but a lengthy campaign, unlike any other we have ever seen. It may include dramatic strikes visible on TV and covert operations, secret even in success. We will starve terrorists of funding, turn them one against another, drive them from place to place until there is no refuge or no rest. And we will pursue nations that provide aid or safe haven to terrorism. Every nation in every region now has a decision to make. Either you are with us or you are with the terrorists.
President Bush addressing a joint session of Congress last night, as well as the nation, a message that was seen around the world. But as Bush announced that the U.S. will go to war, many of those who lost loved ones are saying, "Not in my name." Rita Lazar and Judy Keene both lost loved ones in the World Trade Center attacks. They're raising their voices to call for peace. Rita Lazar joins us from New York, Judy Keene from Connecticut. Welcome both to Democracy Now!
Hello, Amy.
Well, I want to thank you both for joining us, especially in this time of your pain that I think is shared around the world. Rita, you lost your brother, and Judy Keene, your husband. Rita, you wrote a piece in the New York Times, a short letter, last Tuesday, and I was wondering if you could read it for us.
Yes, I'd like to, and if it's all right with you, when I'm through with the letter, I'd like to read something else that I wrote. To the editor, my brother Abe Zelmanowitz was on the 27th floor of One World Trade Center when the first plane hit. Although he could have gotten out of the building, he chose instead to stay with his friend, a quadriplegic who could not get out. President Bush mentioned his heroism in his speech at the National Cathedral on Friday. It is in my brother's name and mine that I pray that we, this country that has been so deeply hurt, not do something that will unleash forces we will not have the power to call back. I wrote my letter to the New York Times because I hoped that if I, someone who had lost a dear brother in the disaster, called for reflection rather than impulsive retaliation, those who read it might also speak out. I still hope that will happen in spite of what we saw on TV last night. Others will speak of the history leading up to this horrible event. I don't have the skill or ability to do that. I just want to say something about my brother. You know about his final act. People call him a hero. I don't think he would think of himself that way. A poem he wrote several years ago reflects how he thought about himself. He wrote, "I dreamed I died and went to heaven. And when I got there, they asked me what kind of person I had been. And I said, not so good. So they sent me down to hell. And when I got there, they asked me what kind of person I had been. And I said, not so bad. So they sent me back to earth. That was my kid brother, not so good and not so bad. This country must allow itself to see its own reflection in the mirror of this horror. We cannot continue to think of ourselves as innocents abroad. What happened 10 days ago was the delivery of that message."
Rita Lazar speaking in the wake of the death of her brother, who died in the attack at the World Trade Center. Judy Keene also on the line with us from Connecticut. Judy, can you tell us about your husband and where he worked?
My husband worked for Marsh McLennan in World Trade Center Tower 1. He was on the 99th floor on the day of the incident. He was very gentle, fun-loving. He loved jokes. He loved to garden. He loved his children above all and his grandchildren. He was a Marine and served during the Vietnam conflict, and actually was in Vietnam on occasion. But I really do not think that he was a peaceful man. He encouraged the kids to participate in sports and always sought, you know, a peaceful resolution to any arguments or incidents that might occur in a ball game. I just feel as though he is saying to me, you know, you really have to put a halt as much as you can to this craziness of going to war. Our children are going to have to be the ones to fight for. And that's unacceptable. I just hope that the president and all those that are in decision-making positions will stop and reflect. Ultimately, it may have to be a war, but right now I'm hoping that people will consider any other option.
There was a peace vigil that you organized, or a vigil in honor of the people who lost their lives outside your house in Weathersfield, Connecticut.
Right.
Close to 5,000 people came.
Right. That was actually for three people in town. There are two young men, coincidentally, one who my husband coached in baseball years ago, who are also missing. The vigil was done by friends and family, not by myself at all, just an impromptu gathering on the ball field across from our home. And it escalated and mushroomed, and more people came. But it was a very peaceful, warm, calming event. It was wonderful. And it brought together a lot of people in town who were in pain.
Can you talk about what you said there?
I didn't speak at that. A friend of ours did. And the ultimate goal of that vigil was for peace. A banner was actually created, which not all of the people could sign, but a lot of people signed. It's covered with names, messages. And we've sent that on via Governor Rowland here in Connecticut to the president, along with the wish. They will consider carefully any steps that are taken.
The media has certainly brought out the stories of interviewed people like yourselves who have lost loved ones at the World Trade Center, the Pentagon. But we rarely hear people like Rita Lazar and Judy Kane talking about or talking out against war. Once your views became known, Judy Kane, did the media come to talk to you about not just who your husband was, but what you think he might have wanted and what you would like to see now?
Well, yes, unfortunately, or fortunately, I don't know which way to look at it, but yes. I've really never sought this notoriety, but I feel as though now that I've started it, I have to see it through to continue this message. And I'm speaking for my husband because I knew him so well. We were married 31 years. And I know that the last thing on this earth that he would ever want is for his children to have to avenge his death.
What did you think, Rita Lazar, as you saw the president speaking last night?
Amy, I can hardly tell you. I was heartbroken. I was more heartbroken when I watched the senators and the congresspeople.
Because?
I can't believe that they are marching forward in this lockstep without any reflection, afraid to be honest with us. And it's we, as Judy has said, who are going to suffer the losses, as well as all the people across our borders who are just as human as we are, who love life as much as we do, who are going to be sacrificed for oil and all those things that your audience knows very well.
Amy, I also don't think that we have the resources to go to war right now. I think that we are woefully lacking in the basics. I'm a nurse in Connecticut, and I can tell you that the shortage here is incredible of nurses. And I don't see where we're going to have enough healthcare workers to take care of casualties. I think that these are some of the steps that have to be taken first before we can even consider war.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves, and when we come back, I'd like to get your final comments. We're talking to Judy Kane and Rita Lazar. They both lost loved ones at the World Trade Center last week in the attacks. The number of fatalities has just increased by close to 1,000 over the last 24 hours as other countries name more of those people presumed to be dead. The number now is at about 6,333. You're listening to Democracy Now! In Exile, just blocks from Ground Zero. Back in a minute. After they speak, we'll be talking with Noam Chomsky. Thank you. You're listening to Democracy Now! In Exile, the War and Peace Report. As we break the sound barrier, our guests are Judy Keen and Rita Lazar. Judy lost her husband in the World Trade Center attack. Rita Lazar lost her brother. Her brother was on the 27th floor of One World Trade Center when the first plane hit. He could have easily gotten out, but he didn't want to leave his quadriplegic friend, and he waited with him until help arrived, and then the building collapsed. In a few minutes, we're going to be talking with Noam Chomsky. Rita's son is someone we all know very well, Matthew Lazar, and he wrote the book Pacifica Radio, The Rise of an Alternative Network. And I just wanted to read the first paragraph as a reminder to all of you of how Pacifica began. Matthew writes at the beginning of the book, "The people who founded KPFA were pacifists. Moved by the principles of nonviolence, they refused to fight in the Second World War. They joined organizations such as the Fellowship of Reconciliation and the War Resisters League. They wrote for and subscribed to pacifist newspapers, and they attended anti-war demonstrations and events. A.J. Mustey, the most prominent advocate of pacifism at the time, was often quoted as saying that, quote, there is no way to peace. Peace is the way. The founders of KPFA wholeheartedly endorse this as their personal and political credo." Speaking about the media, Rita Lazar, as you watch television, not just President Bush last night, but the parade of experts that they bring out, do you feel that there is any kind of even-handed discussion going on in this national forum?
Not at all. The thing that appalls me, I won't say most, after the disaster, the thing that appalls me is the inability of the American people to reflect on what we as a country have done that has unleashed this hatred of us. We think of ourselves as being God's gift to the world. Well, we're not. We have, throughout our history, done unspeakable things, and we just don't seem to understand that there are consequences to all of those acts. Year after year, decade after decade, century after century, we still haven't honestly looked at our own internal history, and we certainly are not looking at what we have done in the world. And until we do that, there's no way for us to do justice.
A number of people have come out early on now to issue strong statements against retaliation, saying wholesale military action could incite more terrorism, not end it. They include Harry Belafonte, Danny Glover, Rosa Parks, and CNN founder Ted Turner, who argued against a military solution yesterday at the United Nations as he delivered a $31 million check to cover part of the U.S.'s U.N. dues. He said, "We should not, I don't think, go around and indiscriminately start bombing countries that we suspect the terrorists are in, because there are terrorists everywhere here in the United States." He said, "What were Terry Nichols and Timothy McVeigh but terrorists?" What do you think about that, Judy Keene?
Well, I do agree with Rita to some degree, because some of the problems that we're dealing with today are our own creation. I really don't have a political agenda, but we lived through the Vietnam era, and I do know that war can be horrible. I guess I agree with all of these highly visible people who are saying that we need to consider peaceful alternatives. Bombing Afghanistan is not going to end all of our problems. And it's just going to create more widows, more homeless children, fatherless children, and more ill feelings. I truly hope that we can find a better way to deal with foreign countries. And I don't know the answer. I'm not a politician. I'm not a statesperson, but that's what they're trained for. I hope they'll use that training.
Well, maybe we can use people like you to be our new politicians. I want to thank you both for being with us, Judy Kane and Rita Lazar, as you speak from your heart after last night's presidential address before a joint session of Congress. I have before me two postcard size statements. They're being handed out around New York at all of the anti-war forums that are now being held, one and two and three a day, just here in New York City. I was at New York University last night, St. John the Divine the night before. Hunter College is having one on Saturday. The Theater for the New City on Monday night in the Lower East Side. And there is a constant discussion and dialogue that is going on all over the city, particularly in Union Square Park, which is at 14th Street, where thousands of people are gathering every night, a kind of peace and democracy park, also surrounded by the thousands of flyers that have been taped up around the city and around this park, pictures of those who were lost in the World Trade Center attacks. I want to thank you both for being with us as we play one of the songs that Clear Channel Communications, which is one of the biggest media networks in this country, has sent out a memo that says, listing a number of songs, that these songs should not now be played. More than 150 songs. Among those songs are Cat Stevens' Morning Has Broken and Peace Train. Apparently he is now a Muslim. Blowing in the Wind. And this song is Bridge Over Troubled Water.
If you only believe when you're down, when you're on the street, when evening falls, somehow I'll comfort you.
Bridge Over Troubled Water, again, more than 150 songs that have been put on a list by Clear Channel Communications out to their stations that should not be played. Aretha Franklin was singing that song. Among those songs also, Imagine by John Lennon. Just imagine, folks. Well, the Bush administration announced last night that the U.S. will soon go to war against terrorism. The media have endlessly pounded on the theme that the U.S. must fight terrorism, attack and destroy terrorist networks, and potentially go to war with nations that harbor or support terrorists. But there's been almost no discussion of just what everyone means when they talk about terrorism. Although Osama bin Laden has become the virtual embodiment of it in the eyes of the U.S. government, in other countries, Colombia, Iraq, East Timor, the occupied territories, the word might include more than that one name. We're joined right now by Noam Chomsky, professor of linguistics at MIT, author of dozens of books and articles on U.S. foreign policy, political ideology, and terrorism. Welcome to Democracy Now in Exile, Noam.
Hi, Amy. How are you?
It's great to have you with us, although on this very difficult occasion. I assume you have read what President Bush said last night about terrorism going after not only individuals, but the countries that harbor and support them. Your response?
He doesn't actually mean what he said, of course. Terrorism has a clear definition. It's clearly defined in the U.S. Code and U.S. Army manuals. It's defined, without going into the details, as the resort to coercion or violence against a civilian population in order to achieve political, religious, or other ends. By that definition, it would be impossible not to accept the statement of the ex-prime minister of Indonesia, Abdurrahman Wahid, that the United States is a terrorist state, in fact, one of the leading terrorist states by that definition, by our own definition. In fact, we even have a name for it. It's called low-intensity warfare, which is a low-intensity conflict, which is actually official military doctrine, and there's plenty of examples of it. So he didn't mean that. What he meant is what's usually meant. We define terrorism, anyone defines terrorism as acts of terrorism that they don't approve of. That's the practical definition everywhere. So he means acts of terrorism that we don't approve of, we will go after by the means that he described. And there's no doubt that the event in question was a horrendous act of terrorism.
One of the things that President Bush said is that if you are not with us, you are with the terrorists.
Yeah, that was already said. We're offering the world a stark choice, as the New York Times put it. Either you're on our side or you're destroyed. There are precedents for that, too.
Can you talk about what this means for countries like Pakistan and, of course, Afghanistan itself?
Well, it depends what the administration decides to do. We don't know. And, in fact, there are counter currents, I'm sure. There must be a strong current within the administration that's listening to what they're being told by foreign leaders, by every specialist who knows the region, I'm sure, by their own intelligence agencies. That if they decide to undertake a massive assault, which will mostly slaughter innocent victims, in fact, victims of the Taliban, if that's what they decide to do, which is the easy thing, we certainly have the capacity to do that, they will be answering the prayers of bin Laden and his network and falling into what the French foreign minister the other day called a diabolical trap. The reason is pretty clear. It'll enable the terrorist networks to mobilize support, appealing to the same kind of reactions that one hears here when natural ones when there's an atrocity. And that will escalate the cycle of violence in accord with a very familiar dynamic, except in this case at a scale well beyond the usual, leading to enormous crimes elsewhere and very likely much even worse crimes here. That's one possibility. I assume that there are elements in the administration paying attention to that. If there is a massive attack which will kill, mostly Afghans, who millions of them are barely on the verge of survival, at the edge of survival now. As for Pakistan, with your question, nobody really knows, but could very well lead to a Taliban-style revolt in Pakistan, which could win, and might might spread to the Gulf region, maybe to Saudi Arabia, at which point the quite apart from the horrible fate of the people involved, it will also lead to a threat to the world's to U.S. control of the world's oil supplies, which would never be tolerated. And at this point, we're off into indescribable global war. That's a possibility. I don't predict it, but it's not an outlandish possibility.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves. We'll come back in a minute with Noam Chomsky. In our second hour today, we'll be going to London to speak with journalist John Pilger. Tony Blair has come to the United States and visited Ground Zero yesterday. We'll go to Belgrade and hear from Jeremy Scahill, the response of those who are also under a reign of terror just a year or two ago. And then we're going to speak with students around the country. Yesterday was a national day of student protest. You're listening to Democracy Now! In Exile. Back in a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now! In Exile, Free Speech Radio, as we break the sound barrier, broadcasting just blocks from what used to be the World Trade Center. This is President Bush last night.
And tonight, the United States of America makes the following demands on the Taliban. Deliver to United States authorities all the leaders of Al-Qaeda who hide in your land. Release all foreign nationals, including American citizens you have unjustly imprisoned. Protect foreign journalists, diplomats, and aid workers in your country. Close immediately and permanently every terrorist training camp in Afghanistan and hand over every terrorist and every person in their support structure to appropriate authorities. Give the United States full access to terrorist training camps so we can make sure they are no longer operating. These demands are not open to negotiation or discussion.
President Bush addressing the nation last night. We're speaking with Professor Noam Chomsky. Noam, you've written extensively about terrorism that the United States government has supported or engaged in. Can you put this in historical context?
Well, perhaps a good way to do it is to take one case which is not controversial, because in fact there's a judgment of the World Court, the highest possible judicial authority, condemning the United States for what it called the unlawful use of force. That's international terrorism. The U.S., of course, this is the case brought by Nicaragua against the United States. The U.S. rejected the judgment, of course, escalated the attack. Nicaragua went to the Security Council, which called on all states to observe international law. The U.S. vetoed it. So there's a World Court and a Security Council declaration demanding that the United States cease its international terrorism, of course, dismissed. Suppose Nicaragua, to put President Bush's comments that we just heard in context, let's imagine that Nicaragua had said the same thing and was in a position to do it. Let's say they had Mars behind them or something like that. Suppose that Nicaragua said that given the decision of the World Court, authoritative decision, Security Council resolution, they demanded with no negotiations that the United States hand over at once everyone involved in any way in the international terrorist attack against Nicaragua, which was very serious. Tens of thousands of people killed, the country virtually destroyed, and that they allow Nicaragua to inspect all U.S. military bases anywhere remotely in the region, all support systems, the ideological institutions such as the New York Times, which was drumbeating for the war virtually without exception, and so on. How would we, and that if that didn't happen, the U.S. would be obliterated. That's a that's rather comparable. How would we react? Of course, you know, it's not a credible threat, but it's only a credible threat when it's made by a superpower that's not under control. But the cases are not dissimilar, except that the attack on Nicaragua was far worse.
I just read in the news headlines a story from the British newspaper The Guardian about the U.S. plans to press its European allies to agree to the military campaign to topple the Taliban regime and replace it with an interim administration under United Nations auspices. Diplomatic cables from the Washington embassy of a key NATO ally report that the U.S. is keen to hear allied views on a post-Taliban Afghanistan after the liberation of the country. And it says that the U.S. military strategy appears to entail supporting the campaign of the exiled 86-year-old monarch of Afghanistan, King Zahir Shah, to return to power by encouraging the guerrilla army of the Northern Alliance opposition to fall in behind him. Diplomatic documents show that Washington is funding and organizing the travel of several Northern Alliance figures to Rome to confer with the exiled monarch, who's expected to call on all Afghan tribes to rise up in revolution against the Taliban. What is your comment on that?
Well, we have a little historical experience there, too, all over the world, in fact, with regimes that the U.S. has instituted, like the, in Indonesia, Guatemala, all over the place, and total horror, some of the worst horror stories of the 20th century. But just let's take Afghanistan. Where'd the Taliban come from? Where'd the Taliban regime come from? Well, you know, its roots are in operations organized beginning in 1979 by the CIA, French intelligence, Egypt, backing from Israel, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, to try to organize an army of radical Islamic fundamentalists to carry out a holy war. If we can believe former National Security Advisor Brzezinski, Zbigniew Brzezinski, he takes credit for having, as he puts it, drawn the Russians into an Afghan trap, that's his phrase, in 1979, by beginning to send aid to Mujahideen, who were fighting against the government, in the hope that the Russians would intervene and fall into an Afghan trap. That is reminiscent of French Foreign Minister Vidrine's words the other day about the United States falling into a diabolical trap set by bin Laden, and he may have been thinking of it because French intelligence was, in fact, instrumental in drawing the Russians into the Afghan trap. Incidentally, I say, if we believe Brzezinski, which is a question, he may be bragging, but that's the claim, at least. The CIA and its associates did look for the best killers they could find, naturally, who happened to be radical Islamists, what are called here fundamentalists. They were brutal and murderous. The U.S. armed them, trained them. They carried out terrorist attacks inside Russia with CIA support. Incidentally, they almost immediately turned against their creators. So one of their first acts was to assassinate President Sadat of Egypt, who was the most enthusiastic of the coalition that was forming them. That was 1981. 1983, a single suicide bomber, probably loosely connected to the same network, drove the U.S. military out of Lebanon virtually. It continued. After the Russians did withdraw from Afghanistan, possibly delayed by these actions, many specialists believe. Anyway, did withdraw, and that war was won. They simply turned elsewhere. I mean, since then, they've been carrying out terrorist attacks against their main enemies, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, other corrupt and repressive governments of the region, which they regard as un-Islamic, and those who support them. And they're fighting in Chechnya, they're fighting in Western China, Kashmir, Bosnia. I mean, the roots of Hamas in Gaza and the West, and the West Bank go back there, too, and they're attacking the United States, which bin Laden himself has, he's been very ill, you know, outspoken about this, no big secret. When U.S. forces established a permanent military base in Saudi Arabia, the one from which they're now planning to, or at least saying they're going to bomb Afghanistan, he and his network immediately described that as comparable to the Russian occupation of Afghanistan, although far worse because of Saudi Arabia's significance as the site of the holiest shrines and so on. So then, yes, going to go to war against them, just as the CIA trained them to go to war against the Russian occupiers. So there is a history of U.S., and out of this in the U.S. came the Taliban. I mean, it's a couple of years later, but it sort of grows out of the same networks and background. So we already have succeeded, and after the Russians withdrew, the Mujahideen, the various groups that had been formed and created, they just tore the country apart, practically destroyed the place. And one of the reasons why the Taliban, terrible as they are, were more or less welcomed is that they at least calmed the internal battling that was destroying what was left of the country. So we have 20 years of experience in Afghanistan itself of U.S. efforts to establish a regime. Yeah, and it ends up with the Taliban.
Noam, what do you think is the most important thing to understand about Osama bin Laden? And do you think that the U.S. government has the evidence to demand that he be sent out of Afghanistan or to say that he's a prime suspect?
Well, if you ask my opinion, I would assume that Osama bin Laden and his network are responsible for this act. However, the stress should be on the word network. It's a very loosely affiliated, non-hierarchic structure. It's, in a way, it's familiar to the kind of affinity groups we're used to. A non-hierarchic, decentralized structure develops in resistant situations and others because it's essentially immune to penetration. It's not likely that Osama bin Laden hiding in some cave in Afghanistan was able to literally direct an operation as sophisticated and horrendous as the one that took place on September 11th, but probably goes out of the loose network. I mean, Bush said last night that these are in 60 countries all over the place, and that's right. If the United States, much of the world has been asking for evidence. So a couple of days ago, the Arab League said, if you can provide us with some evidence, we will join the attack against this kind of terrorism, which they hate even more than the United States does, because they're the main victims of it, targets of it. But the United States can't present the evidence, and it's not likely that they'll be able to. It's going to be hard to find credible evidence about a structure like that, in which most of the people directly involved kill themselves, so you can't go after them. And not only the network, but even its financial resources are, informal, limited, spread all over the place. To try to literally destroy the network and all of its supporters would mean destroying, half the world. In this sense, the call for, NATO too has asked for evidence, and they can't get it, but it's a plausible surmise that that's what's behind it. Well, what do you do in such a case? You have two choices. You can just go bomb, kill maybe millions of Afghans, and then answer bin Laden's prayers, escalate the cycle of violence. Yeah, you can do that. The alternative is to pursue, is to follow the statement of the U.S. bishops that was announced yesterday. Follow national and international law. That means pursue the series of steps that, for example, Nicaragua pursued. I mean, I presume they had the capacity to set off bombs in Washington, even if not to bomb the United States. They didn't. They went to the World Court, received a decision in their favor, went to the Security Council. U.S. blocked it, went to the General Assembly several times, a unanimous vote that the U.S. should stop its attack. U.S. and Israel opposed. And then they couldn't do anything more. But nobody's going to stop the United States if it follows the proper principles of national and international law. I mean, let's take a domestic example. Just, you know, no two cases are similar, but tells you something. Take the bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City. The initial calls, as I'm sure you remember, were let's bomb the Middle East. Okay, you know, kill the bastards. It was, and if there had been any link, however minimal, to the Middle East, that's probably what would have happened. When it was found to have its roots in the U.S. militia movement, those calls stopped. Nobody called for bombing Montana and Idaho to root out the whole militia movement. They went after the perpetrator, tried to discover the perpetrator. They found him, brought him to the courts. And then comes the next step, if you're serious. Why did it happen? You look into the roots of the militia movement. And the fact of the matter is, and we should be honest enough to face this, that when almost every crime you can think of, whether it's a robbery in the streets or a colossal atrocity, there are some reasons behind it. And if you're serious, if you want to reduce the threat of further crimes rather than enhance them, what you do is look into the reasons. And you almost invariably find that some among those reasons, whether it's Oklahoma City or World Trade Center or a crime in the streets, some of them are serious, and they ought to be addressed. And again, you have a choice. If you want to reduce the threat of violence, you think about those things. If you want to escalate the threat of violence against yourself as well, then you disregard it and just lash out violently. Those are almost always the choices. In the case of Oklahoma City, the proper response after following the right criminal procedures was to look into the reasons and ask where this is coming from and try to, and insofar as they're authentic, and to some extent they are, alleviate them.
Well, Noam Chomsky, I want to thank you very much for being with us. As usual, it's not enough time, but thank you for the beginning. Noam Chomsky, professor of linguistics at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and that does it for today's program. Democracy Now! in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. Errol Maitland is at the helm at WBIX.org with Reem. Karen Renucci, Adrian Yenick, Rick Younger, Zoe No, Jeff Galusha, Lyle Danier, Dee Dee Halleck, John Alpert, Keiko Suno, Tony Riddle, Chase Pearson, Lenny Charles, thanks all for helping us out. Democracy Now! Broadcasting from DC TV, Engine House 31, from In Exile from the embattled studios of WBAI. Yes, folks, we are Pacifica. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Ground Zero Radio.
It's bad, you know.
From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now! in Exile.
We've had some of the British victims of the World Trade Center bombings. One man is quoted this morning as saying that Bush ought to be caged. This is not, I think it was his brother, I'm not sure, but I think it was his brother who died. And he, just paraphrasing him, he felt his brother didn't die for a lot of other innocent people to die. That's a very admirable logic expressed by someone who must be grieving so deeply.
British Prime Minister Tony Blair and U.S. senators visit Ground Zero yesterday as President Bush announces the U.S. will be going to war. We'll speak with British journalist John Pilger about the British role in dealing with the issue of world terrorism. We'll go to Belgrade as well as around the United States to students rallying for peace. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now in Exile, broadcasting just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. The figures have increased close to 1,000 to more than 6,000 people who are now unaccounted for. Afghanistan's Taliban rulers today refused to hand over Osama bin Laden and warned that U.S. attempts to apprehend him by force would plunge the whole region into crisis. The announcement came hours after President George Bush demanded Afghanistan immediately deliver bin Laden and shut down what he called every terrorist training camp in the country or face military attack. The Taliban ambassador to Pakistan, Abdul Salam Zayef, called for an investigation into the attacks by the United Nations, saying, "Our position on this is that if America has proof, we are ready for the trial of Osama bin Laden in light of the evidence." Zayef also said he was sorry people died in the suicide jet attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon, but appealed to the United States not to endanger innocent people in a military retaliation, and said President Bush's ultimatum poses great danger for Muslims. And fearful of offending Muslims, the Pentagon is rethinking and will probably change the codename Operation Infinite Justice that it initially suggested for the planned U.S. retaliation against those it considers responsible for last week's terrorist attacks. This according to Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. At a Pentagon briefing, Rumsfeld was told by a reporter that several Islamic scholars had objected to the name, arguing that only God or Allah can impose infinite justice. Rumsfeld replied, I understand, and obviously the United States doesn't want to do or say anything that creates the impression on the part of the listener that would be a misunderstanding, and clearly that would be. Rumsfeld, who decided what to call the operation, said he did not know if infinite justice would be retained, but added, "I doubt it." A Pentagon official said Operation Infinite Justice was a working name that was never officially approved. Rear Admiral Craig Quigley, a Pentagon spokesperson, said names for such operations are suggested by the staff of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to the Secretary of Defense, who ultimately decides what to call them. And the London-based newspaper The Guardian is reporting that the U.S. government is pressing its European allies to agree to a military campaign to topple the Taliban regime in Afghanistan and replace it with an interim administration under United Nations auspices. The Guardian also learned two large U.S. Hercules transport aircraft landed in Tashkent, capital of the former Soviet Republic of Uzbekistan, loaded with surveillance equipment to be installed along the northern Afghan border. The secret landing represents a radical departure since it appears to herald the deployment of squadrons of U.S. fighters at Uzbekistan's sprawling airport of Termez directly on the border. Such a buildup would incur the wrath of Russia, which views the Central Asian republics as its backyard. The Guardian is also saying that another plank in the U.S. military strategy appears to entail supporting the campaign of the exiled 86-year-old monarch of Afghanistan, King Zahir Shah, to return to power by encouraging the military, the guerrilla army of the Northern Alliance opposition, to fall in behind him. Diplomatic documents seen by The Guardian show that Washington is funding and organizing the travel of several Northern Alliance figures to Rome to confer with the exiled monarch, who's expected to call on all the Afghan tribes to rise up in revolution against the Taliban. Meanwhile, at least 1 million Afghans face starvation if the World Food Program cannot return evacuated staff to the country and resume its normal operations there. The 15 nations of the European Union approved tough new anti-terrorist measures yesterday to close legal loopholes that allow terrorism suspects to evade arrest. In the wake of the attacks on the United States, EU Justice and Home Affairs ministers approved 37 proposals aimed at preventing terrorist groups, they said, from operating in the European Union and at strengthening police and justice cooperation with the United States. Key provisions include a European search and arrest warrant, which will allow authorities in all 15 states to search for suspects sought for terrorism in any EU state, and streamlined extradition procedures. Other measures include a common definition of terrorist crimes and guidelines for sentencing convicted terrorists, including a minimum penalty of 20 years for murder. Ministers also agreed to set up an anti-terrorist unit with Europol, Europe's police investigation organization. In related news, the Italian Parliament approved a report on July's violence-ridden Group of Eight summit in Genoa that absolves security forces of blame and described the meeting as a total success. Opposition center-left parties denounced the finding of the official parliamentary commission as a whitewash and published their own conclusions, saying poor law enforcement are largely to blame for the mayhem. One protester was killed by police, more than 300 people were injured, and at least 200 people were arrested. An embarrassed Pentagon yesterday was forced to rethink its choice of the code name Operation Infinite Justice. And the New York Times is reporting, although racial profiling has been harshly criticized, courts in this country have never declared it legally dead. Now, with law enforcement officials focusing on Arabs and the hunt for terrorists, legal experts say profiling may be authorized by judges more definitively than ever before. Some opponents of racial profiling say their efforts may have been set back decades by indications that people who fit a single description, men of Arab descent, were responsible for the devastation. Civil liberties lawyers say there are signs of profiling in the patterns of arrests so far, and security experts say profiling is inevitable in the drive for increased air safety.
Change. Light your lights, yes, but from now on I want you to light them as promises, not memories, as hopes, not losses. This is the doorstep of America, as I've told you, and there, out in the harbor, not there, there, is the real symbol of our nation and our world. As mighty as the towers were, they did not represent America at its best. The woman with the torch does. She stands. Her light is not one of sorrow or anger or regret, of loss or despair, but a light of hope and strength and promise and welcome.
Edwin Starr singing War here on Democracy Now in Exile as we break the sound barrier just blocks from where the World Trade Center once stood. I'm Amy Goodman. British Prime Minister Tony Blair was in New York yesterday visiting Ground Zero with a group of U.S. senators and pledging British military assistance in what seems to be an imminent U.S. war against Afghanistan. Britain lost more than 300 of its citizens in the attacks last week. Blair's visit. Thousands of Afghanis have fled the country in terror, and the UN is warning of massive starvation if food and other aid is not brought in immediately. This morning, British journalist and filmmaker John Pilger wrote in the Guardian newspaper, "During my lifetime, America has been constantly waging war against much of humanity, impoverished people mostly in stricken places. Moreover, far from being the main perpetrators of terrorism, Islamic peoples have been its victims, more often than not of an American fundamentalism and its proxies." The Bush administration's march to war and British support, Pilger argues, promises more of the same. John Pilger is a world-renowned journalist and filmmaker. Among his films, Death of a Nation, about East Timor, films about Cambodia, Burma, Iraq, and most recently, globalization and Indonesia. He joins us on the telephone from London. I spoke to him just before the program began and asked him about the British response to the attack on the World Trade Center towers and the Pentagon, and now President Bush's response to that.
Well, the opinion polls are saying that two-thirds of the country support military action and a third are opposed to it, but that half the country is opposed to any all-out war. Now, I don't know what the questions that led to that kind of result in the polls. But at the moment, a majority would support the Blair government's policies, which have been, as you know, to unequivocally support the Bush administration.
Last night in President Bush's speech, he said, "America has no truer friend than Great Britain. Once again, we're joined together in a great cause. I'm so honored the British Prime Minister has crossed an ocean to show his unity with America. Thank you for coming, friend."
Yeah. Well, once again, they're joined together in yet another uncertain imperial adventure. I mean, when Britain handed the imperial torch to the United States shortly after the Second World War, its consolation was to be given the status of a lieutenant. And that's what it has been very faithfully over the years. So putting aside the irony in the unintended irony in President Bush's remarks, he speaks... what he said is correct.
2 days after the attacks, you wrote a piece, "Far from being the terrorists of the world, the Islamic peoples have been its victims." Can you talk more about that?
Well, undoubtedly, the whole notion that the Islamic peoples are now the terrorists of the world is absurd. Just in numbers, they must be among the single greatest number of victims of terrorism. Just the Palestinian peoples have been that for 34 years and longer. The people of Iraq have lost at least 1 million people and 500,000 children in the Anglo-American imposed embargo against that country. The so-called Afghan Arabs, as they're referred to, people of South Asia, were, of course, the Mujahideen were partly the creation of Anglo-American intelligence. And so it goes on. I mean, it goes back longer than that. It goes back to the breakup of the Ottoman Empire, the deep anger felt in Egypt, where one of the extreme Muslim organizations, the Muslim Brotherhood, was founded. Much of the so-called Islamic extremism comes from is a legacy of imperialism, and the Muslim and Arab peoples have certainly been victims of that imperialism. Middle East and the Gulf have been a cockpit of upheaval, partly because of war, partly because of strategic struggle between the various imperial powers for a very long time. The Royal Air Force of Britain has been bombing that part of the world since the 1920s. So I wouldn't like to make a league table of who are the victims of terrorism, but at a guess, I would have thought the Islamic people, those peoples, are near the top.
We're talking to British filmmaker and journalist John Pilger. His latest film is The New Rulers of the World. You write in your piece how, at the time of the attacks, you were writing about Palestine and censorship. BBC and CNN recently in the last months have sent out memos to their staff, BBC not to call killings of Palestinians assassinations, CNN not to talk about the Jewish settlements in the West Bank, Gaza, in the occupied territories, illegal settlements. How do you describe the media that you are seeing right now?
Well, in the case you mentioned of the BBC, I mean, the BBC has a very considerable reputation because it's of its very high production values. Really, that makes the kind of broadcasting that it does and the distortions in the coverage of the Middle East even greater, in my opinion. The BBC has long drawn a moral equivalence between oppressor and oppressed in the Middle East. And the example that you've just mentioned doesn't surprise me at all. Although over here, I think, maybe in contrast to the United States, I'm not sure, but I think over here there's been considerable enlightenment in recent years about the Middle East. People, I think, are no longer intimidated against being critical of Israel, so with the fear that they might be called anti-Semitic. I think that's going rapidly. But all the same, the general coverage over here of the Middle East adheres to an Israeli news agenda. The Palestinians are generally cast as the people who plant bombs and blow up people and are the terrorists. Israel is seldom, almost never, identified as a terror state operating as an invader against an occupied people.
How is the British press covering the drumbeat to war? For example, President Bush's address, did it air on nationwide television in Britain? And how are they framing it?
Well, I think the majority of them are beating the drum, but there has been more discussion than I've known for a long time, much more discussion, open discussion, than, say, during the NATO action against Yugoslavia a couple of years ago. I think there has been a response to a real public hunger, a need to make sense of all this and to debate it, and a fear of what America and Britain are about to do next. Whilst the majority support the pursuit of the pursuit of the people who are responsible for the atrocities in the United States, there's widespread misgivings, and I think this has been reflected unusually, perhaps, in the press, which usually closes ranks, as it did, as I say, during the Kosovo operation, as it did during the Gulf War. The Guardian newspaper, which took a very pro-war position in the last two instances I mentioned, has allowed a number of articles very critical of the Blair administration, including one by me, which is in The Guardian this morning. So that to me represents a response to certain tensions within the public here at the moment, and confusion as to what is happening. And as I say, a fear and insecurity about what might happen.
John Pilger, President Bush said last night, if you are not with us, you're with the terrorists.
Well, President Bush says a lot of things that kind of just come out of the sort of B-movies I used to watch in Australia as a kid. The Guardian's principal political cartoonist, a minor genius called Steve Bell, represents President Bush daily as, frankly, an idiot. I don't think it really matters what President Bush says. I think President Bush is just one of a Bush team, and that team goes back to the great the great warlord, George Bush Sr. I think that it seems to me that Cheney and all the others from his father's era are really running the show. And you know, Ronald Reagan used to say pretty stupid things, but I think that there are some very serious and worrying people behind him.
John Pilger speaking to us from London. We're going to come back to him in just a minute. He is a well-known British journalist and filmmaker. His latest movie is called The New Rulers of the World, about globalization. And he has written many books, his last called Hidden Agenda. You're listening to Democracy Now! In Exile. We'll be back with him in a minute, and then we're going to find out about a Muslim rally that was just canceled by police in New York. We'll speak with students around the country who protested yesterday, and then we'll go to Belgrade to find out about people there who were recently under a rain of bombs, how they feel about what happened in the United States. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now! In Exile, the exception to the rulers, as we broadcast for you these daily two-hour specials on the War and Peace Report, and continue with British filmmaker John Pilger. John Pilger, you're well known for your films on East Timor, Death of a Nation, and also on Cambodia. One of the frequent guests on U.S. television, I assume on international TV as well, is Henry Kissinger, as an expert on terrorism, but not
well,
in the sense.
In a strange way, yeah.
What's
well,
that?
He's he would have personal knowledge of it, I'm sure.
What about that, framing him as an elder statesman?
Well, you know, the Kissinger record is there. I mean, it's in the public domain. I don't see really what the debate is, but I think there's a growing public awareness, consciousness of what Kissinger has done over the years. As far as East Timor is concerned, we've seen the minutes of his meetings at the State Department in 1975, when he was approving the covert shipment of weapons and aid to the Indonesians, just as they were beginning their slaughter in East Timor. I think his historical role is becoming assured, and it's not really the one that he would want.
Finally, you write that only someone who has never seen the effects of cluster bombs could talk as Tony Blair and Bush have. Well, we just spoke to family members who saw the effects of terror and destruction at the World Trade Center towers. One lost her brother, another her husband, and they want nothing to do with bringing more death to more people. What is your response? They are rarely seen, these views, though they're brought on to describe, you know, their family member that they've lost and what happened in those hours. They're rarely asked the second question, the actual victims, and that is, what would you like to see done?
very difficult to talk to grieving people. I'm not really for that. I don't like doing that. I think it's wrong to ask them their opinions when they're consumed by grief. But some of them have given them voluntarily some very brave opinions, and we've had some of the British victims of the World Trade Center bombings. One man is quoted this morning as saying that Bush ought to be caged. This is not, I think it was his brother, I'm not sure, but I think it was his brother who died. And he, just paraphrasing him, he felt his brother didn't die for a lot of other innocent people to die. That's a very admirable logic expressed by someone who must be grieving so deeply. My own public opinion poll would be that most human beings would believe that there's one truth in all of this, and that is the killing of innocent people in New York and in Washington is indefensible and cannot be justified. And the killing of innocent people anywhere in the world is indefensible and cannot be justified.
John Pilger, British journalist and filmmaker. His latest film is The New Rulers of the World. His book is Hidden Agenda, speaking to us from London. As we continue with this media special, we are broadcasting on the internet at webactive.com and wbix.org. We're broadcasting on public access television, channel 56 on Manhattan Neighborhood Network. You too can get us on your public access station. You can just record from Dish Network, Free Speech TV, and you can call them in Boulder, Colorado. And we're also broadcasting on Pacifica affiliates around the country, as well as Pacifica station KPFA in Berkeley, broadcasting from near Ground Zero, just blocks from where the World Trade Center once stood. And today there are protests planned, as usual, in New York. There have been many peace activities. Last night I was handed postcards that said, "Islam is not the enemy, war is not the answer, let's work to end the cycle, pass it on." And another in bright orange psychedelic colors, "Our grief is not a cry for war." Before we go to students around the country, Sunita Mehta has returned to the firehouse, a member of Women for Afghan Women and Saki for South Asian Women. And she is one of the organizers of a Muslim peace vigil that was supposed to be in New York tonight. Last night, police revoked the permit. Why?
Saki and Women for Afghan Women have been out there doing peace vigils, pounding a peace message to as much of the press as we could possibly get access to. Some of that has actually made it into the press and some hasn't. We're sensing, with Bush saying you're either with us or with the terrorists this morning, I heard that there was a plane that actually booted three Arab Americans off because the rest of the passengers wouldn't fly with them. We're getting nervous. I'm even getting nervous with the rise of hate crimes. It's more important than ever that we can do such a Muslim peace vigil. Saki and Women for Afghan Women organized a peace vigil last Sunday in Brooklyn Heights. 2,000 people came. It was incredibly healing for the Arab American community in Brooklyn, and it made it to so much press, and it's important for a progressive, peaceful Muslim voice to be out there in the world, for the world to see. Now, what happened was that we could be like all the other protests and peace vigils that are going on in the city. There are hundreds and thousands going on, and most of them do not have permits. Because of the sensitive nature of a Muslim peace vigil in Manhattan in these trying days, we went through every appropriate channel, and we got a parks permit to do this vigil in Madison Square Park tonight at 5:30 p.m. Yesterday, the permit was rescinded. It was revoked. And the reason given was that the 13th Precinct was overstretched, could not cover it, did not have the manpower to be there to protect us, and also no sound permits are given to anyone until October 22nd, we were told. And so given that, situation, the parks people said that it's too risky to do this without security, and they rescinded our permit. Even though we said that we would hire our own security, they did not listen, and they took away our permit. It was explained to us that the precincts are really grieving, and they've had their losses, and we did some soul searching last night, our groups, and we decided that we understood the police are overstretched. This is, you know, they probably see us as a sitting target. They're probably thinking of our interests. They want to protect us. They don't have enough cops to protect us. We tried to understand it from their point of view, and we were going to go ahead anyway, because there's no way, no, it's not possible for us to uninvite all the thousands and thousands of people that have invited through emails forwarded on and flyers. People are going to come. And so we decided that we wouldn't break the law, we wouldn't have any sound amplification, and we would go ahead with our signs, and we would speak without a megaphone, and we would go ahead. Then we got another call from the borough command saying that if we showed up, we would be turned away. At this point, we don't understand their side anymore, because they don't have police to protect us, and they have police to turn us away. What are we supposed to think? People say, where's the Muslim voice? Where's the Muslim progressive voice? Where's the liberal Muslim voice? Here it is, and it's being silenced. And we're going to spend the day trying to figure out what we're going to do. We are going to do something. It's not canceled. We're going to be there, Madison Square Park, 5:30. We're going to be there with our signs that say, terrorism is not Islam. Islam means peace. Muslims for peace. We will be there, and if you know, and the press will come, and you know, if the police turn us away, then that will happen. They will turn away Muslims for peace.
Well, Sunita Mehta, I want to thank you for joining us, and next week I hope you report back to us on what happens. We'll also be there today, and we'll record what happens at Madison Square Park, which the cross streets are. Right around 23rd Street to those in New York, and this is taking place at 5:30 23rd Street and around 5th Avenue. Well, we're going to turn now to students around the country who organized a day of protest yesterday. Students at almost 150 college campuses in 30 states rallied for peace. The vigils varied widely in size and scope, but all focused on the need for a cautious and long-term solution to the terrorist attacks. Over 8,000 students and community members came out to demonstrate at University of California, Berkeley's campus yesterday. The day climaxed with a sit-in protesting a racist cartoon against Arab and Muslim Americans that ran in a local Berkeley paper. 19 people were arrested. At the Conservative University of Kansas, students raised $25,000 in 48 hours for relief for the families and victims of the September 11th tragedy before holding two rallies, one on campus and one in the town square of Lawrence. University of Arkansas in Fayetteville had a teach-in for 600 people to learn more about Afghanistan. We turn first to Andy Burns, who is organizer for the Movement for Democracy and Education. He's based in Madison, Wisconsin. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
Tell us about this nationwide student protest day.
Yes, well, it happened at about 150 campuses, which was just an overwhelming amount of support. We were not expecting that much. It originally started as a kind of an idea in the head of some students at Wesleyan University in Connecticut, and they just started talking to their friends. Their friends started talking to their friends. Eventually, it reached the emails and the desks of some, you know, established student organizations, and it just spread from there, really kind of spontaneously and by word of mouth. And it's just like a grassroots outpouring of concerns for peace and for anti-racism and for civil liberties.
We're also joined on the telephone by Kaylin Morris of the University of Oklahoma, where over 200 students rallied. Can you tell us about your day yesterday?
Yeah, we were very happy with our turnout. Being in Oklahoma, we really don't always have a real strong progressive center. So the show that we did have, we were very pleased with, and it was actually a very responsive crowd. We didn't have any problems, and we encouraged people to just have a nice day of peace. People brought their instruments and sang in the center of our university square.
What year are you, Kaylin?
I'm a sophomore.
Mm-hmm. And
political science.
Their ROTC presence?
The main problems that we did have, we came from our ROTC program. We have a very, very large ROTC program at the University of Oklahoma from every branch. And that's the only problems that we encountered, dealt with ROTC members. But I feel like they were resolved very peacefully and quickly, or at least I tried to.
And where in Oklahoma are you?
We're in Norman, Oklahoma.
We're also joined in the studio by a student from Hunter College, Christopher Day. What did you do yesterday?
We also had a peace vigil up at Hunter College in on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. There were, I'd say, between 200 and 300 students, and we had speakers and candles and songs. One thing I'd really like to say is how profoundly so many of us resent having to do this right now in the midst of our grief. Most of the people who organized this event are people who've lost friends or had friends injured or family or whatnot, and it's absolutely horrifying that that our grief is being used to try and build a mandate for doing this to other people.
Did you know anyone who died in the World Trade Center attack?
Personally, I have friends who had very close friends who died. My best friend is a rescue worker who was caught in the collapse of the building. He was injured, but he survived. But he lost several friends, and I've been consoling people. And it's horrible to have to both mourn and organize, but that's what we have to do.
We're also joined on the phone by Tom Graham from the University of New Mexico. Welcome to Democracy Now! in Exile.
Thank you.
What did you do yesterday?
Well, yesterday we had a gathering of students and community that got together for a panel of five speakers who talked about the history of American ethical arguments towards the use of civilians in armed conflicts as targets, either primary or secondary targets, and a public policy, how the drug war can be construed as somewhat as terrorism. We talked about the roots of violence, the role of independent media, and about Chomsky-style deconstruction of media and some political solutions. And then we had a number of students go on a silent parade around campus to show the power of restraint and calm.
And what kind of response did you get, Tom?
Well, we didn't get really any negative response. Only one person throughout the whole thing came up and told us that we needed to grow up. But other than that, we had no real negative response. But the turnout wasn't as large as we'd hoped it would be. We had about 60 solid people that were half members from the community at large and about half students. And we were able to collect about over 100 emails of people who want to get involved and help us organize in the future.
We're also joined on the phone by Sarah Hoskinson from Kansas University at Lawrence. How many people turned out to your vigil and protest?
Our rally during the day at noon, I was estimating about 150 people, and newspaper reports today have said between 200 and 250. And we were out in an open area on campus so people could come and go. It wasn't an enclosed area, so it varied during the day.
What year are you, Sarah?
I'm a senior.
Mm-hmm. What are you majoring in?
I'm majoring in religious studies.
And what did the rally take the form of? Who spoke?
It was an open forum. So what happened was our student body president actually opened up the rally with a Martin Luther King quote, and from that point on, we allowed people to just come up and make their own statements or read statements which had been proposed by other organizations in the past week.
What kind of response did you get as an organizer?
As an organizer, I received some emails from people who are unhappy with the fact that we organized this event. But as far as direct response at the event itself, we had very little negative response. We had a few people who were ROTC students who commented, pointing to themselves and their uniforms, that was the price of freedom. And they just yelled that out from the crowd. So,
Aaron Krieger at Notre Dame, do you have a large ROTC presence at your school?
Yes, we have about 300 people enrolled on scholarship.
Mm-hmm. And is ROTC an issue for the peace activists on campus?
It has been. Ever since the 60s, students have been raising the presence of why ROTC should be at a Catholic university. Many of us believe that the military operates, they're in violation of Catholic just war theory. So we have been definitely bringing up that issue.
And what about CIA on campus?
Yeah, that was another funny thing. The CIA was going to recruit on campus on last Thursday and Friday. So we were planning on organizing a small demonstration of that. And that was seen as very controversial in the wake of the attacks. Fortunately, the CIA canceled their visit. So.
We're also joined on the phone from Cambridge by Jessica Gould, who's at Harvard. What year are you, Jessica?
I'm a sophomore.
Mm-hmm. And what are you majoring in?
I'm a history and literature concentrator.
What kind of rally did you have yesterday?
Well, we had a rally for peace, and I would describe it as being a somber and sort of sobering rally. Our MC, Stephen Smith, when he introduced the events for the day, described that our rally was going to be different than rallies that we've seen before on this campus, in that there wasn't going to be a whole lot of chanting and excitement and waving of signs. It was more set up to be a reflection time because of the tragedy of last week.
Now, Harvard has had a very successful mass movement for a living wage, where students occupied the president's office for weeks, and it got a lot of publicity. Is there any cross-organizing going on right now?
Absolutely. I think there's a lot of overlap between those who did the living wage movement of last year and who are still working on it, and the people who have gathered together to work on the Initiative for Peace and Justice. I wouldn't say that the two groups are exactly the same, but there's been a lot of overlap between the members who are involved, and there's been a lot of idea sharing, and definitely those who worked to write press releases and contact the media have been really helpful in publicizing yesterday's event.
Christopher Day at Hunter here in New York, you framed the protest in a very interesting way, because going to a lot of the peace organizing events, people have been trying to deal with the issue of the mourning around the dead or those who are unaccounted for right now, and that number is now well over 6,000, and having traditional anti-war rallies in the streets, and people have been agonizing over whether that's appropriate. You framed it as being resentful and angry that you feel that both have to be done right now because of the response in Washington. What plans do you now have for these coming days? I mean, there was a mass vigil planned for the dead and unaccounted for in Central Park tomorrow. I think that's been canceled at this point. That was going to be arranged by former Mayor Koch and Dinkins, and now it's going to be a ticketed event at one of the baseball stadiums with Mayor Giuliani. Also, there's a primary next week, which was put off because it was September 11th, and it was postponed, obviously, because of the attacks. But what are your plans?
Well, I strongly believe that the only way we can really honor the dead is to build a powerful anti-war movement right now on campuses and in our communities and workplaces and wherever. And that's what I'm going to be doing, and that's what I hope a lot of other people are going to be doing. I think the Bush administration are behaving like belligerent drunks at a funeral. It's obscene. It's wrong, and they have no moral authority. They do not speak for the people of New York City. They certainly do not speak for those of us who are grieving, people who've lost, loved ones, people who were injured, and we should not allow them to try and to use our grief that way.
There is clearly a distinct difference between what we're seeing on television with the experts being sort of paraded out calling for war and the mourners in the streets of New York. I mean, all of New York is mourning. And we heard at the top of our program two women, one whose brother died in the attack and one whose husband died. And they are saying, not in my name, that they don't want any revenge attacks in their name. Andy Burns, back to you, organizer of the whole student protests across the country yesterday with the Movement for Democracy and Education at WORT. And by the way, a shout out to all the listeners at WORT in Madison. And thank you for broadcasting Democracy Now! in Exile. Andy, what are the plans on a nationwide scale now?
Well, as far as the day of action went yesterday, like I, that was just one event that happened, and it was very spontaneous. But in the future, there, I know for sure that there are several different national-based student and campus organizations that are beginning dialogues with each other to start mobilizing students for a long-term resistance to this war that they're talking about. So there's plans for, you know, potentially like upcoming mobilizations again, there's conferences planned, things like that. So we've got organizational support behind it. It's not just going to be quite as spontaneous as it is before. It'll be more planned and thought out.
Do you want to give out contact information, Andy Burns?
For the organization I work for?
Yeah.
Okay, sure. You can go to, first of all, if you want to see the website for the action that happened yesterday, the National Day of Action, and you can see a list of all the campuses that participated, go to www.peacefuljustice.cjb.net. And there are three organizations in national scope who helped to foster this event along, and those are the Student Peace Action Network, and you can just search for that on the web, the Stark Alliance, and also search for that, and then the organization that I work for, which is the 180 Movement for Democracy and Education. And I would just say just search for all those on the web because they're long websites and you probably don't want to take that much time.
Well, I want to thank you all for joining us, and people can go to webactive.com to get all of the contact information and also hear the program again. Kaylin Morris joining us from University of Oklahoma, Aaron Krieger, Notre Dame, Sarah Hoskinson, Kansas University, Tom Graham, University of New Mexico, Jessica Gould from Harvard, and Andy Burns, Movement for Democracy and Education. And finally to Christopher Day, who is in the studio with us at the Firehouse here in Chinatown in New York, Hunter College student. We're going to do our late break right now for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, we're going to Belgrade, Yugoslavia. We'll be joined by Jeremy Scahill for final words. Stay with us.
Time is running out.
Wendy Smith singing Time is Running Out from the best of Broadside, Anthems of the American Underground from the pages of Broadside magazine. As we go now to Yugoslavia, in the wake of the terror attacks, the World Trade Center and Pentagon, the mass media went around the world to get international reaction. The places they didn't go were also instructive. Places like Iraq, Colombia, East Timor, and Yugoslavia, the most recent country to be visited by a prolonged U.S. bombing campaign. We go now to Belgrade to Democracy Now! Correspondent, former producer, Jeremy Scahill, to talk about reaction there to the terror attacks and the near certainty of a U.S.-led war against Afghanistan. First, welcome to Democracy Now! In Exile, Jeremy.
Thank you, Amy.
Well, where were you when you heard about the attacks?
Well, actually, September 11th was a day of tragedy in my family even before that first plane smashed into the North Tower of the World Trade Center. We were actually burying my wife's uncle here in Belgrade, who had just lost a very painful battle with cancer. And, you know, my phone rang while we were at the funeral, and, you know, a colleague asked me, have you heard the news of what's happening in your country? And I said, I'm not paying attention to anything today. I'm at a funeral. And she interrupted me, and she said, no, you're going to want to hear this. And she told me that this airplane had smashed into the World Trade Center. And then a short time later, my mother called me very frantic and described to me how a second plane had hit the World Trade Center, and then a third plane had hit the Pentagon. And, you know, I was just absolutely shocked and horrified. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. And I have to admit, I was apprehensive about telling anyone at the funeral, even though it was family, for a number of reasons. One was that they were burying their loved one, and another was that everyone in that room, there were dozens of people there, had felt the horror and absolute pain of America's own bombs for 78 straight days in 1999. And they know very well that few people in America rose up to feel their pain or to denounce, you know, those cowardly and barbaric and premeditated acts carried out by, you know, the United States. And so, you know, I was very, very apprehensive. I mean, I was thinking, why should anyone in this room feel sympathy for us, for Americans, you know, when they had to live through this terror that was unleashed by American taxpayer dollars and bombers flying 15,000 feet above their country. But as I started to tell people what had happened, I mean, I was a little stunned by the responses. Everyone began, you know, and they're at a funeral, to ask how my family was. People were offering to drive me to a location with a satellite TV. They offered, a very poor family offered to let me use their telephone to try to call friends in New York, people
Jeremy,
from Democracy Now!
Jeremy, I'm going to interrupt for a second just to ask you to just get onto your cell phone, which we have already called. It'll just make for a clearer connection. Well, we'll keep you, we'll see if we can keep you there on the phone. As we wait, I'll bring you this news. At least two people were shot dead and three others injured today as thousands of protesters across Pakistan demonstrated against their president's decision to help the United States track down Osama bin Laden and punish his Taliban protectors. Police said gunfire erupted at a rally after Friday prayers in the poor area of Sohrab Goth in the port city of Karachi. Protesters shouted, "God is great and down with America," at rallies across the country in response to calls by Islamic groups for a show of support for the Taliban. And fierce fighting raged in northern Afghanistan today as Taliban troops battled opposition forces seeking revenge for the assassination of their leader while taking advantage of threats of U.S. strikes. We are now going back to Belgrade to rejoin Jeremy Scahill. Jeremy?
Amy, there's actually a bit of news out of Belgrade today related to this, and that is that top government officials here are saying that there are what they consider to be credible threats of terrorist attacks here in Belgrade by Albanian extremist groups from the south of Serbia. There's been a lot of focus in the press here on Osama bin Laden's links with the Kosovo Liberation Army. Members of his al-Qaeda network had helped to train the Kosovo Liberation Army, and thousands of fighters from the Mujahideen were fighting with the Bosnian Muslims during the secessionist wars in Yugoslavia during the 1990s. There are credible reports that Osama bin Laden was given citizenship in Bosnia in gratitude for his forces fighting there. This would be consistent with the United States support for the Mujahideen and also the Kosovo Liberation Army. So today in Belgrade, there's also a bit of tension, fear that terrorist attacks are going to strike here as well. But in general, there's been a very diverse array of opinions coming from people and the media here in Belgrade. On the one hand, you have, you know, I think the vast majority of people who are very horrified and shocked that this happened, and their sympathy goes out to the innocent Americans who lost their lives on September 11th. You do have the occasional comments that America deserves it, that America is now feeling what so many nations of the world have felt because of America's bombs, but largely people have an enormous sense of compassion. And I think it comes from having felt that pain themselves.
Amy, on something that's not related to Belgrade, I just wanted to share with Democracy Now! Listeners, if you didn't already cover this today, some comments that were made by the Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld yesterday. And this is a quote that I think a lot of people would find shocking in how blunt it is. And Donald Rumsfeld said yesterday in defining what victory would be in this war against terrorism, quote, "I say that victory is persuading the American people and the rest of the world that this is not a quick matter that's going to be over in a month or a year or even 5 years. It's something we need to do so that we can continue to live in a world with powerful weapons and with people who are willing to use those powerful weapons, and we can do that as a country, and that would be a victory in my view." So that's just the latest in a string of shocking and threatening comments coming out of the Bush administration. People here are very, very nervous that the United States is going to obliterate the very poor and impoverished nation of Afghanistan and perhaps other nations in the region.
Jeremy, I want to thank you very much for that report. You have an interesting perspective. You can watch Serb television. You can also get satellite transmissions from all over the world. You may know more about what's going on in Washington now than most people in the United States.
Well, I think one thing that's interesting is that I've noticed that European newscasts from Britain and from around the world tend to give a lot more attention to the responses from Afghanistan to statements made by the Bush administration. That's certainly not being seen on Fox News Channel, which I get here, or on the NBC network, and to a lesser extent CNN. But largely Europe is covering alternative points of view, while Fox is trying to rally people around President Bush and rally people around the idea of obliterating one, if not more, nations.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us and wrapping up our two-hour special today on the War and Peace Report, which will continue all throughout next week and in these very critical times. Jeremy Scahill speaking to us from Belgrade, Yugoslavia, and we will come back to him very soon in the coming days. For copies of today's program, you can call 1-800-735-0230. You can email us at mail@democracynow.org. You can tell Pacifica stations, you can urge them to air Democracy Now! In Exile, which is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, and Miranda Kennedy. Tuesday on Democracy Now! We'll be joined by Edward Said, and we're going to be talking with peace churches and other religious institutions on Monday, including Michael Lerner in the Bay Area. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. Errol Maitland is at the helm at WBIX.org with Reem Kathuda. Special thanks to Chase Pearson and Tony Riddle of Manhattan Neighborhood Network. Rick Younger is at the controls here for MNN. Hoi No. Karen Renucci, Adrian Yenick, Jeff Galusha, Lyle Davies, Dee Dee Halleck, Lenny Charles, Lizzie Ratner, and our hosts here at Downtown Community Television, John Alpert and Keiko Tsuno. Thank you to the Pacifica stations, especially KPFA and KFCF in Fresno, Pacifica affiliate, with affiliate stations around the country that are airing these special broadcasts. We are Pacifica. You can see the program in New York on channels 34 and 56, that's MNN, nationally on Free Speech TV, channel 9415 on the Dish TV satellite network, and online at freespeech.org. You can also hear the program at webactive.com. We're in the historic firehouse of Engine 31 in Chinatown, blocks from Ground Zero, still in the evacuation zone, in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the Band and the Fire, the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman.